for something in your ear.
Good God Almighty. You know, they put themselves in danger, girls like that.
It was a perverted thing to say.
You'd think you'd learn by that age, right?
Well, he's lay down. What are you doing?
It's okay, hey, you're silent.
What are you doing? Hey, I said, what are you doing? Every week, I go to a club. I act like I'm too drunk to stand. And every week, a nice guy comes over to see if I'm okay.
You okay?
You are so pretty. I am a nice guy.
Are you?
1, 2, 3, 4. I thought we had a connection.
Okay. How old am I? What are my hobbies? What's my name? Sorry, maybe that one's too hard.
Hello, and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and we're back. We've been away for a while, but now we're back with a brand new episode talking about a brand new movie, 2020's Promising Young Woman, starring Carey Mulligan. And my guest to talk about this very interesting movie is my friend and frequent guest and sex education teacher, not necessarily in that order, Kim Cavill. Hi, Kim.
Hi, it's nice to talk to you. It's nice to be back.
It's great to have you back. We had so much fun talking about Secretary and then Clue, two films that have nothing in common except for Leslie Ann Warren. But now we're here to talk about Promising Young Woman, Emerald Fennell's debut film. And there's a bit to say about that, because this is an impressive debut for a first-time filmmaker. But for those of you who have not seen this movie yet, we're going to talk initially a little bit about our thoughts about what we feel about it, keeping any spoilers away, and then we're going to spoil it big time. So if you haven't seen this movie yet and you want to see it, it's available on various streaming platforms and stuff. It's also playing in theaters. Not that anybody's going there. We suggest that you pause this episode, go see the movie, and then come back. But for those of you who don't exactly know what this movie is about, except it stars Carey Mulligan, it's about a young woman traumatized by a tragic event in her past, seeks out vengeance against those who crossed her path. So, Kim, you were the one that suggested talking about this movie. This was something I had wanted to see, but I hadn't gotten around to it by the time we talked. What are your initial thoughts about this movie?
I really loved it for the most part. I didn't like the ending. I really didn't like the ending.
Okay.
Strong dislike. So I would say I absolutely loved it until about the last 15 minutes.
Okay.
But even that being said, even not really being happy with the ending, still overall a fantastic film. Like it I felt like it had a really, there was a lot of confidence behind it, especially for a first time, first, like a debut film. Really, really confident, very strong point of view. It has a lot to say and a lot of really wonderful moments throughout. And so I had been very excited to see the movie, but not going to the movie theaters and everything else over the last year. I wasn't sure how I was going to be able to see it. And so, they did this thing that a lot of movie houses are trying to do, where they released it on the various streaming platforms so you could, rent it for like $20 or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, look, I'm not going to do that just yet. I don't know enough about it to be renting it for $20.
Right.
And so I waited. I think it was about, 2 months that they make you wait until you could buy it for that amount and then rent it for a little bit less. And so, as soon as it was more affordable for us, rented it. And I had so much fun watching it that I told my husband that I would actually buy the film. This is one I'm actually going to buy. And that's not a very frequent thing. I maybe buy 1-2 films a year, if that. Hmm. But this is one I had actually liked to own because I want to watch it again. I have this feeling, because I've only seen it the one time, but I have this feeling that I'm going to see, it's a movie that rewards repeat watching.
Yes.
But there's more, because there's a lot of little subtle moments. And so I'm excited to see it again. Those are my thoughts. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, same thing with the $20. Like, that sticker price is just, no, I'm not going to rent something for $20. So yeah, I waited a couple of months and then, oh, $6.99, that I can do. You know, that's a reasonable price. Yeah, I enjoyed the film quite a bit. I mean, I had heard a lot about it. It was sort of funny when I heard that it got so many nominations. It's been nominated for Best Director, Best Picture, Best Actress. And I remember seeing, you know, wasn't familiar who directed it. And then I saw it said it was directed by Emerald Fennell. And I thought, where do I know that name? I know that's a very distinctive name. Where do I know it? And then I was like, wait a minute, there's an Emerald Fennell on The Crown. And I looked it up and it's like, oh, that's that same woman. She plays Camilla Parker Bowles on The Crown. And I had no idea that she was also a director. I was like, wow, that's really impressive. And yeah, this is a very assured movie for someone's first film. She directed a short film, but this is her first full-length feature. And, you know, there are a lot of movies that I've seen where you get the sense you don't really know. You get the feeling that you really don't know where the director is headed. And it, to me, it's like I've watched movies where I'm like, where is this story going? And kind of a bad way. This was more, okay, I don't know where this story is going, especially in the last 15 minutes. But I never doubted that Emerald Fennell knew where she was going. And that to me was very reassuring to watch. Well, okay, this is a story that is being crafted here and it's executed, no pun intended, very brilliantly. And I can't figure out exactly where it's going, but I feel like I'm in good hands here. So yeah, I thought it was a very good movie. I mean, people have been in some places talking about, you know, it is part of sort of the rape revenge genre, which is a genre. And there's ways to do that are a little on the disreputable side, you know, and then you have something a little on the higher end. To me, this movie has a lot more on its mind than a lot of those other movies. This is more about someone raging against the system rather than specific people. You know, like something like Ms. 45 or I Spit in Your Grave, which are literally just about the violence. This has got a little bit more going on than that. A wonderful performance from Carey Mulligan. You know, I enjoyed it very, very much. And yeah, like you said, it is something that rewards repeat viewings. It's just that kind of movie. So I enjoyed it and would recommend it to anybody that enjoys a really good movie. It's a tough watch. You know, it's not I don't say it's a fun movie to watch, but it's well done and says a lot of things about life in America in 2020. And so, yeah, I would very much recommend it. So, okay. For that said, we're going to clear everybody out. If you have not seen this movie, don't go any further because we are going to spoil it. Kim talked about the last 15 minutes and there's a lot to talk about in that last 15 minutes. As I mentioned, I said it was written and directed by Emerald Fennell. I said it was starred Carey Mulligan. It also stars Bo Burnham, Clancy Brown, Jennifer Coolidge, Laverne Cox, Timothy Goodwin, Allison Brie. It's got a really Christopher Mintz-Plasse in this movie. McLovin is in this movie in a very unfortunate way. As a sex education teacher, Kim, I assume you've got a lot to say about what this movie has to talk about.
Yeah, very much so. I think one of the things it did really well is kind of hold up a mirror to these very kinds of specific experiences that can be so easily generalized to so many people, women in particular, anybody identifying as female. The movie sometimes feels a little bit like several vignettes. You know, you have these kinds of moments that feel so very familiar to me and so familiar to a lot of women and a lot of young students that I've taught, you know, because so, for example, when you first meet Carey Mulligan's character, when you first meet Cassie, and you're following Adam Brody's character, kind of bringing her home from this barn, she's very obviously inebriated, very obviously can't make good decisions.
Yeah.
She's too drunk. And you're just watching this situation get worse and worse and worse. And so much of that feels familiar, even if you haven't personally experienced that yourself, which unfortunately, statistically speaking, a lot of people have. You know, if we're really going to talk about how common, you know, experiencing some type of sexual violence is, it's the numbers are frankly astonishing. Yeah. About how common it is. So even if you haven't experienced that yourself, you know, just growing up in the world that we live in, you know somebody who's experienced exactly that type of situation. And you're kind of over Carrie's shoulder and over Cassie's shoulder, and you're watching her go through this. And it just feels very, very familiar, which is interesting because, like, you know, I think this movie's classified as like a thriller.
Yeah.
And up until the very end, there's not any violence in it, you know, not really. It's just this overarching feeling of imminent violence. And that is, I think, what the movie does best, is to communicate how much of life, depending on how you identify, depending on who you are, how much of life can feel like you're always just this close from certain types of danger. And I think that that's what the movie does best. It communicates that without beating you over the head with it. Does a really nice job. And then, you know, so it uses that to up the suspense and up the tension in the movie all throughout. And I think that's the thing that stuck with me the most. You know, after I'd watched that, and my husband and I watched it, I turned to him and said, I'm going to be thinking about this movie for a long time. Mm-hmm. Because by taking you through these various situations that are so familiar and so tense, it was a very engrossing watch. You're always pulling, you know, you have Cassie that is the protagonist, and you're always pulling for her to succeed. You know, you're always pulling for her to triumph over these different moments. But what's interesting is that each time that you feel like she has, at the same time, it's like a bitter pill, you know, because it's like a bittersweet kind of a victory. You know, if she, so for example, you know, when we first meet her, she is acting very inebriated at a bar, and Adam Brody's character is standing with two of his friends who are outright dicks, you know.
Yeah, just pigs, yeah. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Just making comments, misogynistic comments and objectifying comments like, oh, when they're acting like this, they're really asking for it.
Yeah.
Well, you would have thought she would have learned the lesson by now. And then Adam Brody's character just kind of says nothing while his friends are being dicks, and then says like, look, okay, I'll go over. And the pretense is, of course, like, I'm going to make sure she's okay. And this is always the, like, I'm going to make sure she's fine. I'm going to help her get home, gets her into an Uber. Hey, do you want to just go to my place? And, you know, she's drunk. And even when she seems to have basically passed out and he's, you know, kissing her and touching her everywhere, and she just keeps saying, what are you doing? And what does he keep saying back? Oh, it's okay, you're safe.
Yeah.
It's okay, you're safe. It's okay, you're safe. And so when he realizes she's not drunk at all, that this was an act, and you see that look of shock and horror in his face, that this is not going the way that he thought it was going. And, you know, you're not exactly sure what it's heavily implied, of course, that she killed him somehow, but you're not actually sure. You just see her the next day. It still feels, again, you're like, oh, that's great. You know, she triumphed over this douchebag that was trying to, that was assaulting her. But then at the same time, she's just back out again the next week, and his friends are still at the bar doing the same thing. And, has anything really changed? Is she any better for the experience? And so it's every kind of victory, I think, is, you know, gratifying, but it's also really disappointing at the same time, which is another thing that the movie does well, because I think it's an overarching commentary that for anybody who has actually experienced sexual violence, or anybody who's been close to somebody that experienced sexual violence, quote unquote, justice, we don't even really know what that looks like. Like,
right.
Our system, our institutions weren't built to deal with this problem. They don't really have the capacity to deal with this problem. We don't really have even a very good conception of what justice would look like in these situations. And so it's that same kind of a feeling, you know, is that even when, I don't know, whatever your version of success is, in my version of success, it was going to therapy and experiencing a lot of healing and, you know, raising children without this emotional baggage that I would otherwise pass on. Like, that's my version of justice. But at the same time, it's a bitter kind of a justice, because I know that, you know, the people who did this to me in the past have not experienced any real consequences. And this is kind of the same sort of theme that you hear from a lot of survivors. It's like, well, you have to kind of build your own version of justice that's really specific to you, because we don't have a collective vision of what that actually looks like. And I think the movie does that well, too.
I really liked how the movie sort of kind of like faints left but goes right, because I knew the premise. I knew the idea that she was just this sort of person that was going out and setting these traps for these guys. And when the first one gets sprung, first of all, Adam Brody seems to have cornered the market on playing guys who are initially not bad and then turn into douchebags.
Yeah.
It seems to be his thing. He was in a movie last year called Ready or Not, which was this horror thriller where he's playing one of the brothers in this rich family. And it's all these monstrous people. And he seems like not a bad guy. And then he turns out he's a bad guy. You're like, oh, he always... And that's what happens here is because, he seems initially okay. I want to ask you something about that scene that I was curious about, how you read it. He initially, when he's talking to his douchebag friends, he's trying to be sensitive. He's like, come on, guys. She's clearly had too many. I'm going to see her home. Do you think that that's his shtick? Or do you think that he meant that, and then as he started driving her home – he just decided, oh, this is just too good of an opportunity to pass up? Or do you think he was lying from the beginning?
I think that he believes his own story. And I think that's one of the other messages of these books. Like, because you see the same version of this, I'm a nice guy story.
I'm a nice guy, yeah.
Characters. And what's interesting is that that's actually grounded in research. So there's a lot of research about sexual violence that people have done, or professors have done, you know, on college campuses, as an example. And one of the most interesting findings is that through this research, they found that young men, in particular college-age men, you know, have even ones that have committed some of these kinds of same behaviors, had sex with someone who was too drunk to consent, you know, engage in these behaviors that, you know, are definitely sexual violence, or even sometimes riding the line of right underneath whatever the legal definition of that is, but absolutely over the line of what we would think of as morally acceptable behavior. What's interesting is that even these men who can on these surveys or through these in-depth research interviews, for example, admit that they've done exactly these sorts of things when they're asked later in comparison with people, not themselves, who have engaged in sexual violence or whatever, they're different because they're a nice guy. They've not done anything. And so this, I'm a nice guy, seems to be, research shows, a hyper flexible kind of a story that can grow and expand to cover behaviors that are very, very much not nice guy behaviors. But psychologically speaking, it's a very resilient kind and common kind of a strategy. I mean, that's just why the research shows over and over again with college age young men, even ones who have, you know, perpetrated this kind of behavior, still believe that they're a nice guy. They're a nice guy that did this. And, you know, that definition can encompass all manner of things. So I think you see this version for every kind of male character in this movie, with the exception of Cassie's father, who is, you know, Cassie's father, is that, you know, you see different faces of the same sort of nice guy story. And you see that when that story is threatened, you know, some men, and this is what the movie is also trying to say, like, some men react instantaneously with violence. Some react with misogynistic language and put downs, you know, that kind of thing, because you can't threaten that story. It's integral to a person, you know, their well-being. And I think Adam Brody's character is just like the other, most of the male characters in the movie. He genuinely believes he's a nice guy. And if he had, you know, been allowed to continue and then eventually had sex with a, you know, purportedly drunk Cassie, you know, a week, a month down the line, as research shows, when asked about it, he would still believe, like, well, I got her home safe from the bar.
Right. I got it.
She was safe. I took good care of her. I'm a nice guy. You know, it's a hyper flexible kind of a definition. So I don't think it's as easy as, like, oh, I had this plan, you know. I think it's just a well-established pattern of behavior that we see over and over and over again.
He likes to separate himself from his terrible friends by giving himself that cover of being a nice guy. But it's like, well, what's the difference? You know, you're still taking advantage of someone who's drunk. And what I meant earlier when I said, you know, sort of faint to left and went right, is that after she springs the trap on Adam Brody's character, and by the way, I love the way Carrie Mulligan can sort of drop her voice a register. Yeah. A little, which is really terrifying. And because when she's doing the drunk voice, it's slightly higher pitched.
Yeah.
And she's like, what are you doing? And it's, what are you doing? Like, it drops. And it's very scary.
Yeah.
Emerald Fennell finds a way to shoot Carrie Mulligan, who is not inherently physically imposing. Kind of scary. She has like, she kind of like furrows her brow, and it's really like, whoa, okay. But when she gets out the book, her little notebook, and she's got check marks in it. And you see some check marks are black and some are red. And you don't know what that book is. I initially, when I first saw the movie, not knowing much about it beyond the bare bones of the premise, I thought that meant she was killing. All the ones in red were men she had killed. And I was like, whoa, this is hundreds of people. Like, she's a mass killer on a scale. Is this kind of movie? Like, there's no way somebody can get away with killing that many people, you know, in a town, like, you know what I mean? And then you find out later, no, the red marks mean violence happened. The black mark means no violence happened. Oh, okay. So this movie is grounded a little more in the real world, which made me feel better. That's okay. This is presumably something that could really happen. Yeah. Cassie, would somebody give up their life like this to do what she's doing, which is basically doesn't have a life. We find out right after that she works at this coffee shop run by Laverne Cox. She's 30 years old. She's a dropout from medical school. Everyone is kind of wondering, what are you doing with your life? I mean, presumably you were a promising young woman. And she is not, she even has that speech about, I could get it all, a husband, a house, kids in 10 minutes. I don't want it. Mm-hmm. And she lives with her parents, and her parents, you mentioned Clancy Brown, the great Clancy Brown, and Jennifer Coolidge, and they are so clearly dying to get her out of the house. I love that for her birthday, they get her a suitcase, which is magnificent, a pink suitcase, which she even says, like, oh, yeah, that's fucking subtle, or whatever it is that she says about that. But you're kind of wondering, like, why is this woman living this kind of go-nowhere life when she's clearly capable of a lot more? And then you're realizing, okay, she's essentially giving up her life to exact this series of revenges on these people. And we'll get to it when we get to the end, but it reminded me a little bit of, there's obviously, we're going to find out soon what happened to her friend Nina, who we only see one time in a picture, but like, there's more than just Nina is the victim, because Cassie's not leading a life either.
Yeah.
She's completely given up her life for this. And you get the sense, it's like, well, this thing has ruined multiple lives, not just Nina's or Nina's mother's, mother's in the movie played by Molly Shannon. But this is ruining, this thing is like tendriling out and ruining a lot of people, because Cassie is not really having a life. She's just hell bent on revenge. And it's like, as a moviegoer, that's fun to watch. As you said, you want to see her succeed and get revenge on Adam Brody or Christopher Mintz-Plasse. But it's not much of a life. And so it's sad that even if she does this, what does that accomplish? What's she going to get out of all this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, she's frozen in time.
Yeah.
You know, she's frozen in time. And, you know, that's a common experience too. Even though it was her friend who experienced a terrible, terrible assault, you know, absolutely terrible incident. You know, and Cassie was her friend and therefore kind of a bystander. I mean, that's how trauma works.
Right.
You know, it's not just the survivor themselves. It traumatizes everybody who loves that person too. And, you know, Cassie loved her friend. She loved Nina. And so she's frozen in time. And you know, Nina's died. We don't know exactly how that happened. It's implied, of course, that she took her own life. But Nina's gone. And so Cassie is just frozen, you know, in this moment, can't can't move past it. And therefore, you know, it's just this kind of pattern that, again, it's like bittersweet. You have these, what seem on the surface, like little triumphs, but when you add up the sum of everything, it's not a triumph at all. You know, it's a very empty sort of a victory. Really well done by the movie, but it's very sad. You know, it's very sad to watch. And you see her trying kind of in the middle, you know, she goes to see Nina's mother, of course. So, you know, we have Adam Brody's character that she confronts, and then you see different iterations of this nice guy. And, you know, some of your stereotypical, you know, you have the nice guy, master's film student, you know, who's very impressed with his own creativity and, you know, offers and pushes drugs in order to.
That scene with McLovin is so uncomfortable. He's so awful. I love the set deck that he's got soul catchers all over the place. I just love that. And then like, ooh, he's spiritual. He's got soul catchers on his closet door. Like, oh, okay.
I know.
He's really bright. He's a really deep guy.
Yeah, he's very impressed with himself.
Oh.
Three different versions of this. And then of course, you see Ryan Cooper, you know, who was the student who had apparently had a thing for her, comes by the coffee shop, and you see that he has the potential at least to be different, you know, different from Kat, all of these other terrible experiences with men in general that Cassie has night after night, week after week. And you see her trying a little bit and tremulously extending maybe just a finger to be able to trust this person. And you know, I felt like as a viewer, like you're hoping, but you have this kind of, at least I had in the back of my head, like, oh no, this is going to be terrible. You know?
Yeah.
Oh no, he seems different, but this is going to be bad. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happens. And so you do see in the middle that she goes to see Nina's mom, and Nina's mother says, look, you've got to move on. This isn't helping anybody. And you see her kind of think, okay, I'm going to stop this. I'm going to maybe try it with this guy who seems different from all these other guys. And within, you know, a short frame of time, that whole kind of thing falls to ashes, and she's right back where she started, you know? And you know, it's hard to watch too. You know, it's hard to watch.
I was hoping, except that Ryan is played by Bo Burnham, who directed a movie, wrote and directed a great movie from a couple years ago, Eighth Grade, which was this marvelously sensitive view of an eighth grade girl. It's kind of amazing that a guy in his 30s could craft such a story. But I thought that was a terrific movie. But yeah, you see him, and he's a doctor. Obviously, he said he went to school with Cassie. And he went on, and he's kind of flummoxed. They do have a great meet cute where, yeah. I love the job security that Nina has. Like, she just doesn't give a shit about working in the coffee shop, and her boss is fine with that. She just doesn't care. And then so Ryan orders a cup of coffee, and she spits in it.
Yeah.
And hands it to Ryan, and Ryan takes a big swing of it, which I was watching the movie with my fiance, and when we got to that scene, she just went, baller move. You know, it's like a baller move, Ryan.
Then he asked her out.
Yeah. You're like, okay, I just drank some of your spit. The least that you could do is go out with me, for God's sakes. And yeah, I was worried that, yeah, this guy's going to end up being bad. And I will admit, I was concerned a little as the movie was going on. And I'm like, well, is every man in this movie going to be terrible? Every man? And then I realized, well, the father is not terrible. Clancy Brown. He's a little befuddled because I just think he doesn't know what to do with his daughter, but he's not a bad guy. You get the sense that he really does care for his daughter, and he's just concerned about her. But I was a little like, boy, is every guy going to be bad? And I felt like, well, that's since Emerald Fennell wrote the movies, well, directed, I'm like, well, you're sort of stacking the deck a little bit by making every guy bad. But I also realized, well, that's for some women, that's their experience. And as a man, that's uncomfortable for me to think about, but it's the case. And I will say, you know, when I was in my 20s, a long time ago, when I was in my 20s and I would hear statistics about I think I had heard that like 3 out of every 4 women had been sexually assaulted at some point in their life. I will admit, when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I not that I spent a lot of time thinking about that stuff, but I think I was pretty skeptical of that figure. It just seemed a little high to me. And then I remembered one day, just out of nowhere, it wasn't even anything why it started, but it occurred to me in this moment, but of the women that I had intimate relationships with, and I don't just mean that on a sexual way. I mean, there were women that I was very close with, very close friends with. Of all the women that I knew that I would categorize that I had an intimate relationship with, 75% of them had had sexual assault in their background.
Yeah.
I went, well, there it is.
Yeah.
You know, there it is. There's the statistic in your own life. And after that, I just went, well, okay, this is way more prevalent than any man thinks it is. And it's hard to take that, but that is the case of what is going on here. And so the idea that virtually every guy that she runs into is terrible is grim, but probably pretty accurate, especially if what we find out is that the crowd that she ran with or the crowd that was running in this medical school were pretty bad guys.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it speaks to one of the many things that collectively we're not very good at talking about, which is, you know, human beings, we like things to be as simple as possible and easily categorized as possible, you know, for efficiency's sake. So, you know, we like the idea of like good guys and bad guys, criminals and, you know, law-abiding citizens, legal, illegal, et cetera. But I think that this movie in particular is trying to speak to the fact that we're all capable of things that we don't believe that we're capable of, depending on the circumstances, the context, and the motivations. So, you know, so for example, we'll take Ryan Cooper, the you know, who's briefly Cassie's boyfriend. And when she discovers that this guy who she thought was finally actually different, when she hears his voice on the tape of her, you know, late friend Nina's sexual assault by a group of men, when she hears his voice, he was the one holding the camera, you know, and then when she confronts him about it and just shows the video, you can see this person who I believe, at least in the movie, he genuinely had affection for, he genuinely was starting to love. But as soon as he was confronted with this part of himself that he didn't want to accept, or you know, he had managed to accept under this hyper-flexible definition that he deeply knows won't hold up to anybody else's definition of what constitutes a good guy. When that's shaken, rather than sit with that and reckon with what that means, all of that insecurity and that fear and that rage is immediately turned outward.
Yeah.
And, you know, so then we have, he doesn't hit her, but he has insults and he puts her down and tries to make her feel shit about herself. And, you know, I think that if, again, like he wouldn't have said even 10 minutes before that scene that he had the capacity to treat this woman he purportedly is falling in love with like that.
Mm-hmm.
10 minutes later, that's exactly what he's doing. And we see this version over and over and over again. We're capable of more. All of us are capable of more than we believe ourselves to be. And that includes Cassie herself. I mean, you know, because it's not just men she ends up confronting, of course. I think some of the most interesting scenes are with, you know, the one of the girlfriends who ran with this crowd in college that was at the center of what happened to Nina and then, you know, what happened to Cassie, confronts her about her reaction, which had been to just disregard it at the time and make fun of the two of them, make fun of Nina, make fun of Cassie. And then, you know, confronts the person who was the dean at the college that Nina tried to report the assault to.
Oh man, that scene. Wow.
And, you know, in order to get that leverage over the dean, over Elizabeth, you know, Cassie made her that person's daughter, you know, through false circumstances, go and meet at a coffee shop. But she treated her daughter horribly. And I think, you know, Cassie's obviously capable of a lot more than Cassie purports herself to be. And I think the movie says this about, it's not just men in general, but it's all of us. We're a lot more, we're capable of more than we recognize, depending on the context and the situations. Essentially, like, we can all be monsters. It just depends. It depends in the moment. And so you watch each person in this story and, you know, be confronted with what they're capable to be and surprise themselves, I think, which makes it interesting.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. The scene with the dean of the college, played by Connie Britton, that's after the scene with Alison Brie, where you see that Cassie is able to kind of spring these, not just spring the traps for men, but spring traps for women, too, that they assume are accomplices in what's going on. And Alison Brie is great. Alison Brie has this wonderfully bubbly personality, which she's often is not playing really evil people, which is sort of perfect. It's sort of that beautiful face and bubbly voice kind of hides this really moral rot inside of her. And I think she must choose these roles on purpose. But the scene with Connie Britton, you know, I've seen a lot of movies that are thrillers or supposed to have some level of tension and can't make anything tense. You know, I mean, I've seen whole movies that are supposed to be tense and they can't, you know, they're boring. The director just doesn't know what they're doing. This scene with the college dean springs out like a mousetrap, and yeah. The way Emerald Fennell handles it, and she doesn't do anything complicated. It's just these two shots of Cassie and then the dean going back and forth where she starts telling the dean about what she's doing. And she says, do you remember who this person was? And she says, who did Nina speak to? And she says, you. And she says, but you can't remember. And then the dean has some sort of comment like, well, you know, we get a lot of these and we can't trust them all. And you're like, well, maybe that's the problem. You're getting so many accusations that you can't, one or two a week, she says.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty bad, Dean. Maybe you ought to look into that. And instead she sort of reverse engineers that as like, look, we get so many of these, we can't possibly investigate them all and they can't all be real. So what do you want me to do? And you're like, wow. I mean, the disassociation she's made, and that Emerald Fennell really makes that scene tense as hell. Cause I started to wonder, did Cassie like murder this daughter or something? And then of course she didn't do anything. She just basically set her up to make the dean sweat a little, but it works perfectly. But my Lord, what a marvelous scene. And again, all credit to Emerald Fennell for knowing how to direct that and make it, to me, I was so nervous.
Yes.
What was going to happen at the end of this sequence?
Yeah, I was nervous too, for sure. And I think, you know, and that's a little commentary to me about, you know, this whole thing of like, it's the attitude of, you heard this a lot during the Kavanaugh hearing, you know, and all the discourse around that. Of, well, I have daughters, you know.
Oh God,
mothers and daughters, and it's like, right, you know, using the women in your life, you know, as a shield. And in this case, you know, the dean is using institutional failure as a shield, because it is true, not in the dean's defense, but I think that to validate Carrie's frustration. You know, at the end of the day, you know, when she's saying, look, Nina reported what happened to you. And, you know, the dean's response, Elizabeth's response is to say, well, right. But, you know, we have to presume everybody's innocent, you know, until they're proven otherwise. And unfortunately, in that case, you know, it's just the nature of this, that when someone comes forward to say, look, this person, you know, harmed me, this person assaulted me, this person did, you know, whatever else, and wields an accusation, the presumption of innocence, just by its very definition, rightly or wrongly, outside of all of the morality of it, means that if you're going to grant this person who's being accused of presumption of innocence, that's only done by presuming that the person wielding the accusation is somehow lying. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you see all of this, confused kind of the discourse always follows the same patterns, like, well, she's lying, or she misunderstood. And we heard all of this cycle of excuses and bizarre reasoning, like during the Kavanaugh hearings, you know? And so I think that that's what this vignette, the scene with the dean, does really well, is to say, like, well, you know, we had to give him the benefit of the doubt, essentially. And then the problem is, like, so Cassie's essentially asking an institution for, again, this thing called justice. And the institution is simply not built for that purpose. It's just not. And I think that until we reckon with that, we're just going to continue to talk ourselves in circles and circles and circles with nothing that feels like justice to survivors, certainly, and nothing that would feel justice to us collectively. Because I think we haven't even really confronted with the fact that the institutions as they currently exist just aren't built to do what we're asking them to do. And so Cassie's asking for that. Of course, the institution says no. And when she's got her institution hat on, says, like, well, we can't do that. Now, of course, it's implied that the investigation was never really properly carried out. If they had done any kind of investigation, they should have been able to discover the evidence that proves that Nina was true. So I'm sure that there's a lot of deliberate institutional failure that could have been rectified. Cassie has every right to be angry about that. And then as soon as it becomes not about this theoretical person, Nina, who's no longer a threat because she's dead, and as soon as the safety, you know, becomes about the dean's daughter, all of that institutional shield falls away, and you see the dean start to panic. And so then you see how they really feel, and it speaks to that kind of, I think, dichotomy, is that you have people's public kind of a discourse, and that's not the same as somebody's private kind of a feeling, you know, when it becomes about them and not about somebody, you know, else who's really a threat.
I like how the dean is very measured and clipped, you know, and then when she realizes that the trap is with the daughter, and she's like, tell me where my fucking daughter is. Like, she jumps, you know, like, okay, she's cutting through all that because she's panicked now. It's just an amazing sequence. And, you know, there's a lot of, angel imagery in this movie. There's a lot of things of, like, Cassie standing in front of a wall with, like, angel wings painted on the back behind her. And the scene where she goes to see the lawyer from the case, played by Alfred Molina, the great Alfred Molina. I love that when she shows up and he opens the door, he looks, has this look of, like, I've been waiting for this my whole life. Yeah. As we see that he has been eaten away from the inside from what he did. And he talks about that basically, yeah, this case obviously got railroaded because they basically smeared Nina as a slut. And he even says, you know, you wouldn't believe how easy it is. Just one, you know, photo on a social media feed and that's it. But Molina only really has the one scene. He appears later on in the film, but I don't think he even says anything. But man, he does a lot with that one scene. I mean, I bought that he was genuinely haunted by this. That doesn't make it okay, but I do get the sense that he is sort of ruined by this. He knows what he did was wrong. And his energy, in fact, his passion for how terrified he is, it even scares Cassie a little bit. We see that she kind of backs up and is a little uncomfortable because he is just so intense. And, you know, this whole idea that she is this person who's going to she's setting everything right. She's going through every one of these people. I also love too that there is the scene where she tries to spring one of her traps on the guy with the fedora, and she gets caught by Ryan, who sees her. I love that in between the master plan, she's still freelancing on the side too.
I will always think of him as Richard Sweat from Beat because he was my favorite. Yes. That was a good scene too. Yeah. The douchebag with the hat.
Yeah, he's got the fedora on. You're like, okay, all right. And so you get after that, we have the scene with Molly Shannon, as you mentioned, is Nina's mom, who basically says, hey, you got to get over this. You know, you have to move on with your life and things like that. And, Cassie doesn't know how to do it. Then there's a brief sequence, kind of like a montage, which is almost like a rom-com where we're seeing Cassie and Ryan being all cute together. They sing in that pharmacy, that weird neon pharmacy stuff, and they're fumbling around in bed together. And did you get the sense that Cassie, I mean, hard to know because you don't know the mood, you know, you don't really know what the Emerald Fennel's intention was. But in your mind, do you think that if Cassie had found a way to be happy with Ryan, she would have given up on this plan? Or do you think that that scene where she's trying to trap that guy with the fedora shows that she was still going to do this regardless of whether she was in a happy relationship or not?
I think that, you know, when she was trying to trap Richard Splett, when she was trying to trap the fedora guy, and then Ryan caught her, and kind of like these two pieces of her that hadn't ever really had to connect before were in conflict with each other. I think in that moment, she decided, you know, she was at least open to the idea of choosing the part of her that wanted to be with Ryan, not out, you know, doing this repetitive revenge kind of a thing that, for all of the individual good it may or may not be doing with these individual men, it's at a tremendous cost to her, and it's not realizing the kind of institutional change that she is actually begging for through the whole movie. And so I think when those two pieces of her come into conflict, I think she finally realizes the cost. And when she's confronted with the cost and how much this is costing her, she's like, well, maybe I could. Mm-hmm. Maybe I could do this. And I think she's not necessarily, I think she's thinking about trying, you know, taking these baby steps. And that's why you see this rom-com scene where they're, you know, singing to Paris Hilton, which I thought the soundtrack in this movie is awesome. Like the sound is fan-fucking-tastic. It's really great. So it's the silly scene. And, you know, then you see them in bed and they're maybe kind of loving each other. I think she's genuinely ready to at least try. But of course, you know, that's snapped away when we find out that Ryan, you know, was an integral part of this traumatic experience with her friend Nina and Cassie that froze her in time.
Yeah.
So, you know, snaps it right off and then it's full steam ahead.
There's a common refrain through some of the male characters in this movie, which I've heard in real life, sadly, but this idea that there are some guys who are sort of willing to own up to the bad things they did. But when you say, okay, well, that means you're going to have to lose your position of privilege, they're like, oh, wait, not that though. And you're sort of like, well, what punishment are you expecting to be meted out then? You know, like you're acknowledging that, yeah, what you did was bad, but geez, I should still get to be a Supreme Court justice. Wait a minute. You know, wait a minute. And, you know, Ryan's like that. I mean, when Cassie reveals to him that she knows, he's like, oh, my God. You know, he owns up to it. I mean, partly because he has to. He owns up to it. But then he's like, are you going to – he doesn't say this explicitly, but it's basically like, are you going to go ruin my life now? And you're like, well, do you think that just acknowledging that you were part of it is enough? I mean, you know, like what price are you looking to pay that is acceptable to you? Because, like, of course you're going to have to, it's going to have to be revealed. How else are you going to pay for your sins? Just admitting it is not enough, but that seems to be a comment that felt like something right out of real life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Harvey Weinstein's, you know, that are like, why? Hey, I'm a big movie producer. I've rocked up Oscars. So what? Yeah, who cares?
Yeah. One of the darkest things about this movie that has a lot of connection to real life is that you see a lot of different versions of, you know, this nice guy who's not really nice. But honestly, each one of these people, you've seen a lot of different versions of successful men. You know, you've seen a lot of different versions of what looks like to be very, very successful men. And the very uncomfortable question at the heart of this movie is, you know, this ladder that you're climbing to success seems to have been built out of other people's pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when that success is threatened, so Ryan's like, well, are you going to ruin my life? It's like, you only have your life because you stepped on other people to get here. So, and that's what, that's one of the many things that makes this so hard to see. You know, you see And that's why Ryan tries to put her down and is just like, well, wait a second. Like my life that I've built does matter more to me than the people I stepped on to get here. Mm-hmm. You see that over and over and over again, because I think that one of the things that I believe this movie is trying to at least talk about is, have we built into our institutions and our society the implicit agreement that it's worth the cost? You know, that is the price, and we're willing to pay it. Because I think that by refusing to, you know, and we see people failing over and over and over again to really reckon with the scale of the problem, what this problem means, how to solve it, and our continued refusal to do that in multiple different aspects is essentially a tacit agreement saying, yes, we know, and yes, it's fair. You know, yes, we know that many of these people in positions of power, most of whom identify as men, step on other people in order to reach the levels of success that they do. We understand that, and we've decided that it's worth the price.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's drawing. I mean, literally pulled from the title, pulled from real life, is the Brock Turner. He was a promising young man. The judge said, "Well, he was a promising." What difference does that make? If he committed a rape, what? So what? We've got lots of doctors. We've got lots of lawyers. It's fine.
It matters for some. It certainly doesn't seem to matter for others how promising.
Yeah. Yeah. What difference does it make? So,
a couple of times, like with that conversation, and then again at the very end with Al, you know, we hear like, "I was just a kid," you know, and she
was 22 years old. Yeah.
She looks and she's got, I think she, you know, she looks like this and she's like, if I hear that one more time, you know, and you can just hear this, like, because Ryan said the same thing, like, we were just kids, you know, if I hear it one more time. And then all she wants from Al, remember at the beginning, is for him to admit what he actually did. And when he gets close, like, I didn't, and you hear the beginning of an R and he can't bring himself to say the word rape. I didn't, and you can see her with, you know, and Carrie Mulligan is so good at this kind of like cheeky, but still very menacing.
Look. Oh, it's very menacing.
Very, very, you know, to say like, you didn't what? What didn't you do? You know, because she knows he can't say it. He can't even bring himself to confront what he did. But he has the same, like, I'm getting married. You're going to ruin, what do you want from me? You're going to ruin my life. And it's like, you have this life. And the movie makes this explicit connection because, of course, Nina and Cassie were the top two people in their class. Mm-hmm. Remember, they were the top two people in their class. This happened. Al and his friends raped Nina. Cassie was involved, of course, as a bystander, both traumatized, so heavily traumatized that they dropped out of school. And lo and behold, Ryan can take valedictorian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which he's very proud of, and he's built this life on this scaffolding. And again, the movie's saying, like, right, that the ladder that you got to this place was built out of my friend. You know, I mean, that you climbed on her back to get where you were. But, you know, when what you're essentially saying is, well, she wanted to be there. Or, you know, she agreed. Or, right, but I have this life, and it was, you know, we were kids. It's done now. Like, how, you know, so what? It's worth the cost.
Yeah. So during the final sequence, which again, if you haven't seen the movie, I don't think we've spoiled too terribly much at this point, but the ending is, again, if you haven't seen the movie, don't listen to this part because we're talking about the ending. The final sequence where she dresses up in the nurse costume and they pretends to be a stripper, and she drugs everybody, knocks all the guys out, and then gets out and straps him to the bed. And she immediately, she says she's going to carve Nina's name in his chest, which he flips out. And then he manages to get free. And then it's this moment where they wrestle and he suffocates Nina. And it's a, you know, it's a brutal, I mean, obviously seeing in any respect is brutal. But Emerald Fennell, I read, purposely let it run. She apparently checked with her father or somebody who was a doctor and asked, how long does it take to suffocate somebody? And he said, well, basically like 2.5 minutes. So she lets this run for 2.5 minutes where he has got a pillow over her face. By the way, again, with the set deck, there's this weird, like, on the bed behind the behind the headboard, there's some sort of like stitch weaving thing. And it says yeehaw, which feels like a, you know, okay. Yeah. And he's got his neck on the pillow and she's writhing and writhing and writhing. And then she dies.
Yeah.
He dies. Nina dies. And I will say, I remember watching the movie and when that part came up, I went, this movie still has 15 minutes left to go. Where is there left to go with this movie? I was really flummoxed as to where, like, that. This is, wow, this is the end of this. This woman did this on purpose, maybe. And so this, I guess this is the part where you said you don't like this turn.
Yeah, I didn't, but I understand on one level, I can understand it for, you know, it does. Because, of course, like you said, there's 15 more minutes. So we essentially see that, you know, she's done the not unfamiliar film trope of evidence that goes out in the event of my death.
Yeah.
You know, that eventually takes this ring of people, implies that it's going to take this ring of people down. But my issue with this was that I understand that might seem like something resembling justice, but maybe I'm just too cynical of a person for the ending to resonate with me. Cause I think there were a couple of things that had I been, you know, in the writing chair, I would have at least had questions about. And one is that no matter what happens to these other men with what other evidence and, you know, the cops and everything else, I felt like the end, you know, the end is essentially saying, well, in order for anything to happen to any of these people, rape isn't enough. It has to be murder, you know? And unfortunately, if we're just going to go on, you know, the outcomes of our legal system alone, that's generally true. But it's so disheartening that I didn't want to see it at the end of this movie, you know, like, it's such a depressing reality that we all have to think about that. I was hoping for something different in the movie, but I felt like it's like, okay, so in order for any sort of consequences, she has to die now. You know, it just seemed like, again, it was too heavy of a price, right? Too heavy of a price to pay. I didn't like that. And I also felt like, it said, I didn't know what it was really trying to say then, what that meant about Cassie, because it does seem as if, I mean, she planned obviously for the eventuality of it, but in some ways it seems to play a little bit like she had a death wish and this was kind of what she wanted. She just couldn't go on anymore. She was done. There wasn't anything else to live for, you know, and she just wanted to be out. And if she could take this person and these people down with her, then that's just the best outcome. And, you know, that to me isn't a message of hope and resiliency, which isn't necessarily what the movie was trying to give.
Right. Yeah. Right.
No, but that's something I would have enjoyed more than kind of like a death wish to say, like, well, there's nothing else really for this character to want or to do. So she just wants all of this to be over. The only bit of the ending that I did actually like was, again, when the detectives come to see, you know, Ryan Cooper, the boyfriend, again, and ask, like, do you know where she is? And he knew where she
was. Exactly, yeah, he knew where she was going. Yeah.
And he decided in the moment, again, to lie. So you just see this guy who insists that he's a nice guy and a good man. When push comes to shove, only makes the most self-interested decision, you know, over and over and over again. So it showed that as well. And then the other thing that I liked was Max Greenfield.
Oh, character. I was about to mention that. Oh,
yes,
so
friend Max. Now talk about a guy who's really good at playing like the veneer of guy smiling that's just covering a whole.
Oh, an whole utter mess on the monster. Inside. He's an that scene after he discovers he comes upstairs because he's woken up, and he thinks the stripper is just unconscious.
Yeah.
And then he finds that she's dead. And then you see Al start to cry, and he jumps on Al, and it becomes this perverted inversion of the whole telling a woman who thinks she's to blame for being raped that it's not her fault. It's this ugly negative version of that where he's comforting his friend. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. And this guy's crying, and he's like, it's not your fault. And you're like, of course it is his fault. He murdered her. What are you talking about? And it's like, these two guys are so clueless and so venal. And the way also after they burn Cassie's body and Max Greenfield finds the necklace in his pocket and the way he tosses it, he just is like, meh, like it's a piece of lint he found. Oh, my Lord. Max, he is so good in this movie.
He's great.
You know that Max Greenfield, if you dig into his background, this character's background, there's some bad stuff there, because nobody is that comfortable with hiding and burning a body unless they've done some really horrible other stuff.
The moment that I love the most, and there's a bunch of really effective close-ups, and I know that when we talked about Secretary, we talked about how, you know, that last shot in the movie where Maggie Gyllenhaal's character breaks the fourth wall and just looks right at the camera.
Right.
It's not breaking the fourth wall in these movies, but there's several close-ups on people's faces in this movie that I feel like are so effective. One of them is Adam Brody's character when he looks up and sees that she's sober.
Yeah.
And the look on his face is astonishing. And the look on Max Greenfield's face when, you know, he's saying like, oh, it was an accident. And Al, you know, he's crying. And he does try to argue back with Max's for just a little bit. He's like, but I, you know, like I, and then as soon as Joe hears that Al's saying anything other than it was an accident, remember, he kind of gets closer to that, and he gets up to the camera, and he was like, it was an accident. Oh. You know, and looks, and it's like it's such a whole conversation in just one line and one look, which is like, you have to say this and you have to believe it and you have to tell yourself until you believe it, because it was an accident. And, you know, again, it's that, and again, I feel like this whole movie is talking about different rungs of this ladder that some of these, you know, predators, these men climb to success. So, and that's another rung on the ladder. It's like, it was an accident. And we're going to keep saying that because that's what it was. And that's what we believe it to be. It was an accident. I didn't mean to. And I thought that Max Greenfield, I mean, he, again, a guy that doesn't have much screen time, but makes what he has is just fantastic.
Oh, man. And it's sort of taking what you, I mean, most people just know him from New Girl, and it's sort of taking that persona, that Schmidt persona that he had on that show, and again, like flipping it and like revealing the dark side of it.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, that's what this guy is like in a non-sitcom scenario. He's a sociopath. You know, he's an utter sociopath. So in terms of the ending of Nina dying, I mean, yeah, I did find it to be, you know, a downer, because of course she's ostensibly your hero and you want to see her survive. But the thing that it reminded me of, and I forgive me for this story winds a little bit, but I remember back when I was like 14 or 15, there was some guy found in Philadelphia that was like was revealed to be like a serial killer. He somehow, cops found him and went into his house, and there was like a dozen bodies stacked up, and he became this. Anyway, so he goes through the legal system and he ends up being executed. And I remember being, I think it was in, I must have been on the bus, because I think the bus was playing like the local news station. And they talked about that he was being executed in the morning. And they mentioned that there are a bunch of people outside the jail celebrating that he's being executed with like funny signs and, you know, like Shock the Monkey and stuff like that. Ooh. And I remembered thinking, there's no victory here. There's nothing to celebrate here. The reason this guy is in jail and the reason he's getting the death penalty is because he killed a bunch of people. I can understand the idea of feeling that justice is finally being meted out, but there's nothing to party about. You know, I mean, you could feel how you feel about the death penalty, but I think at the best, you just kind of grimly say, well, okay, that's that, yeah. You know, but it's not something where you were like, woo, you know, with a big foam finger or something. That's to me, I feel like that's what Emerald Fennell is sort of saying by having Cassie die, is that it's like Cassie has gone on this road where there's not going to be any winners. The act of Nina being raped and then her eventual suicide is, as I said, spiraling out to where there's no winners here at all. It's all just dark. Yeah. That is eating away at everybody. And yes, Cassie is ostensibly our hero, and she's getting her revenge, and she does get it in a wonderfully kind of inventive way with the texts and the you know, all the stuff to be done after she's dead, and she leaves the half of the necklace with her boss. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but it's grim because there's no good that can come of it. Yeah. There everything is worse because of this event. Everything is worse. Mm-hmm. And there's no positives here. And that's kind of a dark ending, but it's a dark tale. You know, I mean, it's anything that where the main instigating action is a rape. There's not going to be any upsides to it.
No, that's true.
You know, so I was okay with it.
Yeah.
Even though it does leave you feeling incredibly downbeat that, you know, everyone is just suffering horribly because of all this.
That makes sense. It makes sense. I'll be interested to see, you know, because art is reflecting, and it's one of art's functions is to hold a mirror up to society. And so as we're having these conversations, I think we'll see more and more art about exactly these kinds of things. And I'll be very interested to see art that presents a vision of what justice or what healing might look like. Because, you know, this movie doesn't really attempt to do that.
No.
I'm not sure that anybody really knows the answer to that yet. You know, I don't know that anybody has a really good idea. And I'll be very, very interested to hear any ideas that come up, especially, you know, ideas that are communicated through movies and, you know, where people use their imagination to try and sometimes dream of what might be. And, you know, when I sit and say, like, look, our institutions aren't really built to handle, you know, this, what is frankly an epidemic of sexual violence, not built to deal out any kind of justice. Do we even know what justice, you know, what fixing that would look like, what justice for that would look like? And I'd be really interested, you know, to see any art that tries to grapple with those questions, not just the question of, like, you know, the questions that this movie grapples with, which is, you know, how nice are these nice guys really? And all these other things that we've talked about. I'd like to see art that grapples with, okay, so now what for all of us, what does that look like? Because I don't think we have any collective answer for that yet.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a really well done and well executed film from a you know, again, a first time filmmaker, which is just remarkable, and it speaks to the moment. And I don't know, I there are other, not that it matters a whole lot, but I hope to see that it wins a couple of awards at the Oscars, because I think it deserves it. I mean, there's a lot of other great films in contention, and I think it's going to end up, you know, being a kind of a good year because of so many movies got sidelined because of COVID. Movies like this can sort of pop through,
yeah,
in a way that they might not have, because this is obviously not a big, you know, the subject matter and the star, it's not big ticket. This is not a Marvel movie or anything like that. But yeah, it's a really, really remarkable movie. And I mean, geez, it's something that I want to watch again, even though, like I said, it's grim.
Yeah.
It's something I want to see again to sort of pick up things that I might not have seen the first time.
I think the soundtrack helps with that too.
It's a great soundtrack. It really
kind of bizarre, you know, more upbeat soundtrack, which clashes nicely with the darkness of the film. You know, that the whole last sequence of her going into the bachelor party, you know, dressed as a stripper to that orchestral version of Britney Spears's Toxic. It was, you know, fantastic. So I think the soundtrack helps with the wanting to watch it again too, because at least that was inventive. And you know, I, until I heard that Paris Hilton song, I'd repressed that that had ever even been a thing. Like, oh my God, I remember this. I'd totally forgotten about it until now. So whoever did the soundtrack, I think, did a really nice job.
Yeah, it's and the movie does end on a smiley face. It's a digital one, but it does end on a smiley face. So yeah, I mean, that's Promising Young Woman. Like I said, I think it's just a terrific movie, and it has a lot to say about our moment. And I mean, is there anything else we want to say about it before we wrap up, Kim?
No, I think it's definitely worth the $7 or whatever Amazon or Apple's going to make you pay to see it. Or, you know, request that your local public library buy a copy so that you can rent it for free. That's always a good one as well. But it's definitely worth the 2 hours for sure.
Absolutely. So, well, this is marvelous, Kim. I mean, this is great. I really enjoyed this film. And again, it's not something I would have necessarily thought to talk about on the show, but I'm glad that we had a chance to have this conversation. I always enjoy talking to you. You know, you kind of always up my game a bit. And I always appreciate you coming on the show to give a perspective that I would not be able to have normally. So thank you so much for coming back. And please don't be a stranger. And why don't you let people know where they can find you on the internet?
Sure. You can check out my podcast, 6 Minute Sex Ed, which I make for families to listen to together, or, you know, teachers to listen to with young people. Talks about all sorts of things in very, very short nuggets of information about sex, relationships, and growing up. You can find me as Sex Positive Parenting on Twitter, and you'll know it's me because my profile pic is still the late, great Madeline Kahn from the wonderful Mrs. White. So you can find me there too. And you can find me on Insta at Minute Ed. So yeah, you can check me out there. And thanks for having me on. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you. Really appreciate it. Had a great time.
No, you're very welcome. So, of course, everybody, we can find back episodes of the show on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. We're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, you can go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big thanks to my pal Corey Musa for his support of the Film and Water Podcast. So we went a long time without an episode. And now we're back with Promising Young Woman. And there's actually going to be a couple more coming down the pike pretty soon. So we're kind of clumping them. It's just sort of the way it's working out. So keep your eye on this feed. There's going to be some other movies that we're going to be talking about on the Film and Water Podcast. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next time, that's a wrap. I'm old enough to face the dark.